welcome to A Bookish Home. I'm Laura Zara Kopinski. This week, Mary Giuliani joins me to discuss her new book, Tiny Hot Dogs, A Memoir in Small Bites. Mary Giuliani is an author, party and lifestyle expert, and founder and CEO of Mary Giuliani Catering and Events. Mary has appeared on The Barefoot Contessa, The Today Show, Good Morning America, and The Rachel Ray Show. Her new book is called Tiny Hot Dogs, A Memoir in Small Bites. Ina Garden praised the book, saying, "No one tells a story like Mary, and she does it with great recipes, too. To read her deeply personal memoir is to feel that you've connected with a dear friend who's thoughtful, funny, and truly unique. I love this book." I totally agree. Mary Giuliani, welcome to A Bookish Home. I'm excited to get to talk with you.
Thank you so much. I am so happy to chat with you.
So tell us a little bit about the memoir. I really enjoyed reading it, and I would love to hear sort of some of the inspiration for it and just some backstory for people who haven't gotten to take a peek yet.
Absolutely. So this journey really started about 10 years ago, or I guess I could say it started as my childhood. I had wanted to pursue a career in acting post-college, and I, tried like everyone else does, went on all the auditions, had doors slammed in my face, tried out the Actors Studio for James Lipton, where he kindly reminded me that it took Sally Field 9 auditions to actually get into the school. I only tried twice. And during that time, I just took a job just to pay the bills in a catering office for a catering company located in the East Village in New York City. And it was one of those times where, I'm sitting there and this is just a job that I took just to pay the bills and because I was, on to something bigger. And it took me all about a month that I worked in this office that I realized, oh my gosh, this is exactly what I want to be when I grow up. It combined theatrics, it combined food and hospitality, which I did come from a long line of eaters and greeters, I call it. I decided that to trade in like one dream for another, and I adapted this very like if you can't join them, serve them type of mentality as it came to my career, and really dove in headfirst and learned everything I could about the catering world, and then eventually 3 years later decided to start my own company. So as I had gratefully had a little early success in my catering company, I still had that bug to perform. And so I sat down and I wrote inspired by a Nora Ephron play I had seen called Love, Loss, and What I Wore. I sat down and I wrote a one-woman show called If You Can't Join Them, Serve Them. And my idea was you were going to come to the theater and I was going to share all of these stories from my catering journeys sort of like a behind-the-tray look into a lot of different worlds. And if you were in the audience, you would get a small bite or a small drink of the story I was talking about. And that was great. It flew effortlessly. Writing it was, the most fun I had. It flew effortlessly out of me until, again, I got back to that, I get on the stage and there was a reason my acting career didn't really take off. And, but I had all these great stories and I really wanted to share them. So, when it was time to, I'd written a cookbook in 2015 called The Cocktail Party, which was great. And it was, a lot of tips and how to's. But really what I loved the most about writing that book was the stories. So when it got to the point, where I got another chance to write another book, my editor said, okay, so what would you like it to be, another cookbook? And I was like, no, I'd really love to just tell my stories, pure and simply. And so that's how Tiny Hot Dogs began. And I really decided to, I didn't really want to write a memoir. I hadn't felt that I'd done anything in my life to warrant a memoir on the cover of my book. but I did feel like I had stories that I think people could connect with, either, growing up feeling like you were on the outside, like I did, or getting to, post-college, what do you do with that degree? Do you have to use it in the way you were told you were supposed to? Can you break norms? Can your dreams come true by just finding, maybe a non-direct route? And also then combining in all the things that we love about food and storytelling and hospitality and gathering. That was a very long way to answer your question.
No, I love it. It's so nice to hear. And I always think it's interesting to think about, like, now looking back at your journey, how all these little twists and turns sort of led you here and help, you know, it's the stories for the book, but it's also, you know, you've done the cookbook and then you've got the recipes and the memoir, just like all these little things sort of leading you to this place that incorporates a lot of your journey. I think that's interesting. But yeah, the stories are so relatable and funny. I just think it's a very unique memoir, I think, and just a very entertaining and like sort of lighthearted in a lot of ways, but also you go into serious things too. And so I guess if we back up a little bit, you start off in the beginning with some stories about your childhood. And we know that eventually you do wind up going into the catering business, and you write a little bit about sort of your food history a little bit growing up. Could you talk about your mom and sort of the Italian family you grew up in, and, sure, and what role cooking had in your life as a kid?
Absolutely. So I grew up, so we were very Italian, and I joke, we were so Italian that both my sister and I had a mustache just like my dad. We grew up very traditional. We grew up very, my grandparents moved into our home sort of at the end of their life. They had both been diagnosed with pretty serious illnesses. My grandmother with Alzheimer's, and my grandfather was had kidney failure and was going through dialysis treatment. So they moved into my life at a time, you know, that magic time of childhood. I call it like the 8 to 12 pocket, like where, you know, you're becoming who you want to be, but you're still a kid. And there's still so many, you know, things, you believe can be possible. And so I had this very fortunate, moment to live with my grandparents in our home where being very Italian, it revolved around cooking and entertaining. So we would, you know, traditional, you know, Saturdays would be, we would cook all day. First, I would stop, you know, I would start shopping with my grandfather in the morning. We'd go to all the various markets that, you know, there was one guy for meat, one guy for vegetables. You know, we would take this journey. The shopping in itself was this amazing treat. And that would take half the day. Then we would come back and all of us would just be in the kitchen, and there'd always be music playing, and there'd always be chaos and stories. And it was always just, the kitchen was filled with music and conversation and people coming in and out, and it's probably the happiest memories of my childhood were that. And Sundays, you know, we'd have, you know, 20 cousins come over and just big bowls of pasta and grilling outside. And so it was a really wonderful part of my childhood that I'm grateful for. And then I would come home from school every day, and I was fortunate that my mom was able to be home. And she'd be cooking most days. So I would do my homework on the kitchen counter. And this was her stage. And this was her time to not only, you know, show me, you know, she'd always cook wonderful meals. And it's funny, I never actually remember her sitting down and teaching me any particular recipe. It was like osmosis. I just sort of learned everything by watching her so many times. And so she would use this time with me for both cooking advice, but also life advice. And she would throw in all these very funny life lessons that I talk about in the book. There's a whole chapter devoted to my mom and the things that she taught me or would, you know, over the counter.
I love that chapter. I was going to say, I noted, I loved some of her advice, like always save 2 meatballs after you fry them before throwing them into the meat sauce for someone you love. That yes, was so cute. Yes. And then I loved her saying about, you can always just whip up a quick frittata. Mm-hmm.
She was so always cute, whipping up a quick frittata. And she loved if there were leftovers from her. She loved nothing more than if there was like a cheese board left over. I would always see her be like, oh, we can make a great frittata with this cheese.
I'm always amazed by people where cooking is just second nature and just something they like don't even really seem to have to think much about. It's just, you know,
I know
they're just, it's just, it's come so easy to them now.
And it's funny. Mm-hmm. No one taught her either. You know, she watched her grandmother and she and her mother. And, you know, that's why I think I have that chapter in the book, I'm Not a Foodie. Which is funny for me to say that since I've made a living in food. Because for me, it just sort of, food was life. Food was not a fad. Food was not a trend. Food was not something you took pictures of as, you know, growing up. It was just something that was so part of us. Not that I mean, I love the way the food world has turned out, and I love how passionate we are about it. But it was just funny to be, you know, categorized, you know, I am a foodie. When for me, like growing up, food was air, like cooking was air.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it was interesting. So from growing up in such an Italian family, you wound up also studying abroad in Italy too. Could you talk about that experience a little
bit? Yes. So my junior year of college, all my girlfriends had applied to the a year abroad program in Italy, and I kind of wanted to go, but I also had never traveled very far from home. We weren't a family that traveled very much, so that just sounded like it sounded like going to Mars in some ways to me. Going to Italy, and all my other girlfriends had been a little bit more, well traveled, and it just to them they had the the proper response to going away abroad is, and I just it was just a little harder for me to wrap my head around it, but I knew it was something that I wanted to do. First, I didn't want to be left behind, but also I knew it was a good way to step out of my comfort zone and actually be around real Italians, which I thought we were the most authentic Italians in the world. That was a culture shock once I got to Italy, that we were just American, Italian Americans, and true Italians are different. I mean, it blew my mind that pizza wasn't in slices, the very simple things. But we sort of, I kind of was like an accidental tourist, and I kind of was really grateful to my girlfriends for possessing all the right, travel wear and map guides and even like, the right shoes to walk around in. And they really like, I always felt kind of like the fifth wheel, traveling with them. And I look back now and I'm incredibly grateful for that experience. And it was really defining in my food philosophies and everything like that. But, I rewarded my friends for putting up with me, really basically like, pulling me through all these little towns we would travel to, hemming and hawing sometimes. I rewarded them with a hot dog and beer party in the villa gardens that we lived in. And I was kind of proud of myself that I think it was probably the only hot dog and beer party that was ever thrown in these beautiful gardens. And I'm proud of that.
I loved that. Well, that sort of leads into I thought it was interesting to read about how when you started your own catering business, you had a different vision than what you had been doing and some of the catering you'd been doing before. And I thought it was funny you were writing that the parties you had been catering, you had said it was from 2000 to 2005 in New York. Everyone wanted smoked salmon, cobb salad, Chilean sea bass, and tart tagine, and that's all. That was what all the parties were. But you had sort of a different approach you wanted to take. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so the catering company that I learned everything and incredibly grateful to, was a very polished, very like silver tray caterer, and the clients that we were working with were pretty much like New York society, and so that was my first glimpse at all that entire world. It was completely foreign to me, but it was interesting to learn about, and it was interesting to see. But I realized that everyone was just eating the same thing. Like it was just like someone passed this mandate and was like, okay, this is what, if you are high society, these are the five things you're allowed to eat. And it was great, but it also were things that, just some things that I thought you could be more creative, expressing yourself through food and beverage than everyone was being. I also remember just looking at a party and being like, these people have a lot. And they're just like us too, though. Like maybe once in a while, they just want a hot dog or a little grilled cheese sandwich. So when I started my own catering company, I decided that I was fortunate to work with such, high-end people, but I wanted to, give a very simple and special approach to the food that we were doing, because that's the kind of foods that I liked. When I wrote my first menu for my own catering company, I included all of the favorites. And like when I look back and read it, it's like reading a kid's menu at a restaurant. But it's, things like pigs in a blanket and little grilled cheese sandwiches and mac and cheese donuts and just all these things. I wanted a very playful and whimsical and approachable. There's a space absolutely for high-end food and all of those, the fancy preparation of it, but that wasn't who I was. And so I made the decision to be the most authentic I could be in both how the foods we were serving and also how we were presenting it. So our tray displays were whimsical. Sometimes those worked, sometimes they didn't. But it was really my best attempt to be the most creative food and beverage extension of my clients, whatever they were celebrating. And our business does mostly cater to corporate art, fashion, entertainment type clients. So it was a really good way to, kind of step out and be able to articulate, the food and the experience, just to be a creative extension of what they were trying to, you know, say or do. So
yeah, for sure. Do you have, it could be one you mentioned in the book or a different one, a favorite dish at the moment that when people pick it off of your menu or offerings, you're really excited to be serving?
Yes. I mean, I really love we've been doing since the beginning this tiny truffle grilled cheese, but it's not truffle oil. It's black truffle honey. So it's fontina. It's a, you know, grilled cheese sandwich with fontina cheese, and we drizzle in a little bit of black truffle honey. And that is, to me, one of the most delicious bites. So it's like a nice way that it is just a very plain, you know, you could take a sandwich and cut it into 8 little pieces, and a sandwich can quickly go into a very fancy little hors d'oeuvre. And so that I would say is like one of our best sellers and also one of my favorites.
I love that. Well, so you do mention the whole idea of if you can't join them, serve them. And I think people will be very interested, in sort of some of your celebrity encounters and things. Is there any you could share with us that you'd want to go into?
Yes. Well, there's one particular, I say, like, I've decided to follow this tray of hot dogs into so many amazing rooms and places. And often I still am just the girl with the hot dogs, but I get to see a lot of great things. And so one story I talk about, at the time, this is many years ago, I had a very large crush on Alec Baldwin. It was like 30 Rock time. I was very obsessed with his character. I loved him. And I was catering a very, very lovely party where there was a lot of celebrities. And, you know, sometimes when you do these parties as the caterer, you don't even see the party. Like, you're just in the kitchen. You know, sometimes, you know, if you're doing tabletop and you're organizing that whole part, then yes, you're involved in that. But if you're there just doing the food, sometimes, you know, in these rare cases, you don't even go into the party because you are just the caterer. And this was one of those parties where we were just the caterer. And, so halfway through the party, the kitchen door swings open and in walks Alec Baldwin. And at the time, I mean, everyone, my whole staff, everyone knew that he was like the love of my life. And I was like, oh my gosh, like, who put him up to this? And he walked into the kitchen and he's, you know, his first question was, who's in charge? And I kind of, you know, looked behind me and I was like, oh no, that's me. And it was me. And I just stepped up and I said, I'm Mary, I'm the caterer. And he said, oh, that's great. I'm looking for you. And I was like, what? Like, and in walks someone else and takes him back out. It was like, he got interrupted. Oh, Alec, come see someone. So he walks out and I'm like, wow, he's looking for me. And like a normal person would be like, you know, he's just maybe needs something. But I was convinced that he was in love with me. And he came back in again and we start talking. He's asking about the catering company. He's asking me about what's on the menu tonight. And I'm telling him, and yet again, someone comes in, interrupts us, takes him back out. And this was, after the second time he came in, I was like, oh no, he's really in love with me. Like, he feels this. This is where the universe has decided to place me. And, you know, yes, I am a happily married, I was at the time a happily married woman of 10 years, but my husband would understand. And, you know, once he got over the shock, you know, it would all be for the better. And then finally the third time he walked in, I was like, this is it. And he's like, Mary, can I ask you a question? And I just looked up at him and I said, yes, Alec. And I was literally ready to leave my worldly life behind me. And he said, do you think you could get me a Diet Coke? Because they just don't have any out at the bar. And that was it. The romance
soul
was over.
Crushing.
Soul crushing. My waiter said, oh, I poured the saddest Diet Coke they'd ever seen served in their life. And out walked. Oh. Yeah. And luckily I got to go home to my husband and he still took me back.
At least you got the brush with him and got to chat with him a little bit. But
exactly.
Oh, that's funny. Well, one of the other things I thought was interesting in looking, even just at your bio, you've done so many big talk shows and things, and the Barefoot Contessa and the Rachel Ray Show. Where did that side of things start? And I just could imagine, you know, you watch some of those like food demonstrations and things on those shows, and it seems so nerve-wracking to me because it's not like you're just sitting there talking, you have things that could really go wrong.
Absolutely.
So I'm just curious what that is like.
If you could do live television cooking, you could like land an airplane during a plane crash. Like, I just feel like you, like live television cooking is so funny because it's like, first of all, I don't know about you, but I never cook in a dress and heels. Like I,
yeah, not so, so much.
No. So that's like the first thing. So it's like, oh, I'm sorry. And in full hair and makeup. So you gotta, you know, you put the heels on, you put the dress on, you put the hair and makeup, and then you have to go outside and in 4 minutes you have to cook 6 things and talk and try to talk about, you know, and try to give useful tips and try to, it is completely nerve wracking and crazy. But if you could get through your first one, then I feel like, you know, each one after that gets a little bit easier. My first one, I out of nowhere, because of the nature of my clients, I started to get a little tiny bit of press. And someone, I don't know who was, dubbed me this caterer to the stars, which I still kind of shrug when I say, and it is on like a lot of, it's on my website and it's on a lot of things. But I don't know, when you hear that, you either, I don't know, just caterer to the stars. It just sounds like, who is that person? Because I never felt like that person. But anyway, so I started to get a little bit of press. And because of that, I was asked to do very early on the Today Show. And I remember that it was with Kathy Lee and Hoda. And I was incredibly green and didn't really know what I was doing, but I just got out there and you get this adrenaline rush and you just, you know, for me, I got there and I was like, I can't believe I'm getting the opportunity to do this. I have to make it the best I can. But you are sweating through your armpits. You are nauseous. You are, there is, you know, at least I was, and then, but it's like conquering a fear. Once you get over it and you're like, oh, it wasn't terrible. Like I got through it. Then, you know, I started to do a little bit more. And then when my last book came out, in 2015, The Cocktail Party, one of the producers received from the Rachel Ray Show, Tara Fogarty, I love her, received a copy of the book and she read it cover to cover and just walked into Rachel and said, I think you're going to love this girl. Like you guys have a lot of similar, you know, a lot of same sensibilities. And so they booked me on the show and lo and behold, Tara was right. And, I think I've been on Rachel now like 16 or 17 times.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I found a really nice home over there and Rachel's been really gracious. I write about Rachel too in the book, the chapter Lady Lobsters, which is, about how to treat women, you know, how to support each other as women and build each other up instead of, you know, pull each other down, which I think historically we've been doing. And Rachel really has supported my career and given me, you know, shared her audience with me, which was really kind of her. So, so the TV stuff. So it's, again, I keep going back to like, I didn't set out, you know, just your dreams can come true. Like I find myself like, yeah, I kind of did make it on TV a little bit, like, you know, it did work
out. Yeah.
So.
Well, and that maybe you can't always know what the dream is going to wind up being until you keep sort of chugging along and seeing where things lead.
Exactly.
So I know you did the one woman show, was transitioning to writing down all the stories for the memoir, and sharing them in that way. Was that intimidating at all to take that on?
Not really. So I was an English major in college and that doesn't mean much, but I was an English major in college and always journaled and always wrote. Like writing to me was, I remember once I went to this like happiness workshop and they said, they just looked out at the room and said, okay, first question, is there one thing that you do that you absolutely lose track of time? You have so much enjoyment. You don't think about anything else while you're doing it. And like you look up and it's 2 hours later and you're still doing this task. And just immediately it was writing for me. And, you know, I was a little, when I was a younger girl, I used to write, you know, stories and create all these little scenarios in my head and write them down. So the writing part was really quite easy for me because it was sort of like yet another thing, like, yes, that's something I've always wanted to do. Thank you so much for allowing me to share my stories. And so prior to my daughter being born, I have a 4-year-old daughter, mornings were like my most sacred writing time. I would for years, even it was also my therapy to the crazy world of catering. It was a place that I could go. You know, when you're around so many people all the time, catering parties and loud and noise and just lots of people, writing was my little sanctuary. It was a place where I could just be with myself, someplace quiet, and still play make-believe. Like I did, like whenever I sit down, it's like I have the ability to just dream up something on a page. And I love that. My morning ritual was always getting up really pretty early. I'm an early riser, so like 5:30, 6 a.m. I used to be excited if I beat the sun, and now I can't wait to sleep past the sun. But I would make myself a cup of coffee and set up my little set up on my desk and just kind of go for it until usually the second cup of coffee. Then the genius kind of wears away, and and now with my daughter, it's kind of been a different ritual. So I had to sort of teach myself how to write at night, which I never wrote at night. But I found that it was easier after I put her down now to kind of, so it just all depends. But the writing part is really something I've just loved. It's a very zen. It's a very, in a world that we're constantly checking things and, social media and all that stuff, it's just a really nice place to still escape for me.
Yeah. That's a nice way to look at it. And yeah, I guess it would be such a nice sort of counterbalance to the busyness of catering and the constant noise and people and all of that. Did it take you a long time to write? Well, because you were also trying to fit it in around your catering business, which I imagine is very demanding.
Yeah, it did. I was lucky because some of the stories I took from the play, so that was great. So I had I had like two or three stories that I felt were strong enough to go into this this collection. And yeah, it took me they were pretty good. I think I kept getting hung up. This is what I kept getting hung up with this book about. This who cares question we ask ourselves like all the time as writers and just as people, like anything we're doing. Who cares? Like who's going to really care about my story about that I used to play Johnny Carson with my grandfather? Or who's going to really care? And then so I would sit there and I would get in the way of myself from sharing what I wanted to do. And then once I started to really tackle, the issues of my infertility and things, and I think after I had written about, my struggle with infertility, I said, someone is going to care about this, because I know I was alone when I was going through it. And I wish that someone had been, spoke so frankly about what it was going through, or endometriosis, which is the illness that I suffer from. And so once I wrote that one, I was like, you know what? People do care, and just kind of get over yourself and keep writing. But that was one of my biggest hangups, because I would sit there and I was writing for like the audience instead of myself. And then I just sort of started just to write from the heart. And I was like, you know what? Some of these will get tossed. I had a wonderful editor too, who would toss some of them. But the ones that she kept kind of gave me confidence that like, oh, someone will enjoy reading this. Like there's an essay in the book called The Captain and Tennille that I literally wrote. It's about my turtles. And my husband and I had pet turtles for they're, one of them is still alive, almost 20 years later. And I wrote that it was just like actually almost like a break from my writing when I wrote that. I was just like, oh, the turtles, wouldn't that be funny to write a story about the turtles? And I just wrote that story. And then I read it back to myself and I was like, wait, I love this story. Like I found myself laughing at my own writing. And I was like, oh gosh. And I sent it over to my editor. And I was like, I don't know, this one's kind of random, but maybe. And we both agreed that we think it's one of the best stories in the book. But
no,
just never
I totally
know.
Agree. That's what I was going to say. You just don't know what people are going to connect with. And that's part of what I loved about it. Some of them are so quirky and funny, and others just really do make you stop and think, or you're connecting in some way. I just thought it was great that you were so open about certain things like your experience with infertility. I just feel like there's not that many I don't know. I think it's really helpful to be open about those things and for people to be able to connect. And for me, like, I always think so much, like, in terms of kids' books about, we talk about this whole idea of, like, windows and mirrors into people's experiences. And I was thinking with this one, like, oh, you know, even as an adult, you need those books that you kind of see yourself in different ways. And I think certain stories will definitely be that for people, like, oh, you know, I thought I was the only one that happened to, or struggle with that. So I think that's really wonderful.
No, it's really nice. And that's what I've loved the most, the comments that I'm getting from people. Because you got to put this, you know, you put your life out there and you're like, oh gosh, you know, this is so scary. I was terrified, like, weeks leading up. I was just like, it's terror. And then you get like those initial, like, oh gosh, you know, I really connected with, I too felt like an outsider growing up. I too. And it's just, you never know which story it's going to be. And it's just so lovely to hear from people and see, you know, how, what resonates in them.
Yeah. Well, I was curious. I know it's probably an annoying question to ask when you have just gotten this book out, like, is there another one in the works? Yeah. But I will ask anyway, is there another one in the works?
There actually is. So, When we sold the book, I said that, you know, I grew up truly dearly admiring two writers very closely, Lori Colwin and Nora Ephron. Everyone loves Nora, and everyone loved Lori too. Lori had a wonderful collection of essays, but she was a much better chef than I was, and hers were. But she had these just very simple essay collections, and so when I told my editor, my dreams, you know, I said, I just hope that, let's see if anyone falls in love with this first book, because if they do, I got plenty of stories and I would love to just continue writing essay collections. And we were laughing, like, you know, the next one should be like the girl with the crab cakes, and, you know, we keep this tiny hot dogs, crab cakes, shrimp cocktail, poo-poo platters. Just, you know, continuing to share the ups, the downs, the human element of our everyday. You know, I like to say, like, we are all fighting all the same battles. We're just in different wrapping paper. And you know, just really, truly connecting. And I hope, you know, that for me, you know, I'm not, it's self-deprecating. Yes, I tend to be. But I also really want people to, you know, to see their power too, because maybe I did dream this all up as a child. I did dream of big things. And, but, you know, you can get stopped along the way and people could tell you no. And I was told no by a lot of people in my career, in my fertility journey. I had 16 doctors told me I would never be a mother, and, in, you know, not so many words. And so, I think you can really, truly, construct your fate by just believing in yourself the most, and having a certain optimistic delusion, which is I am optimistically delusional, and I think we should all have a little bit more of that in our lives.
Yes, I love that, and it is inspiring to read and sort of be rooting for you along the way. So I will, I'll definitely be looking forward to the next collection.
Thank you.
And and I just wanted to end. I always love hearing what writers are reading. Is there a book you've read lately that you'd want to recommend to listeners?
Yes. Can I say two quickly?
Yes, please.
Okay. So one right now, because it's also memoir, and it's a beautiful, beautiful memoir. It's Erin Lee Carr's All That You Leave Behind. She is the daughter of New York Times columnist David Carr, and he passed away. And it really, and it's basically it's her journey of her life through remembering him through his both text and emails, and just the time they had on the surf together, and what a story. So I've really been enjoying that. And then there's another book by Lydia Finette, and this is a best friend plug, but it's just a funny story because our books came out on the exact same day. One of my closest friends in the world that I was that I started on my career journey with 20 years ago, and just coincidentally our books came out on the same day. Her book is titled The Most Powerful Woman in the Room Is You. And that is a empowerment for women on how to sell themselves in their homes, in the boardroom, in taking the negativity that's associated with the word sale, selling. And she's a dynamo, and she talks about, you know, a lot of, you know, she has a lot of inspiring stories. And so the Lydia Finette, Most Powerful Woman in the Room, is a definitely like a how-to self-help empowerment book. And All That You Leave Behind by Erin Lee Carr is a beautiful and also inspirational memoir about her time with her father.
Those both sound great. I've definitely heard of The Most Powerful Woman in the Room. I feel like I might have listened to an interview with her. I'll have to go back and check, but I'll link to both of those and to your memoir, Tiny Hot Dogs, and also to your cookbook.
Thank you.
If people want to go check those out, I hope they do. And just thanks for coming and sharing some of your stories with us. And it was just always, I love hearing the behind the scenes of the book. So
absolutely,
it's great to get to chat with you.
You're a wonderful interview. Thank you so much, Laura. I really, and I appreciate your patience with setting this all up too.
Oh, of course, of course.
For links to all of the books mentioned on this week's episode, you can head to abookishhome.com. There you will also find other book recommendations and links to past podcast episodes. To learn more about Mary Giuliani, you can visit her website, marygiuliani.com. You can also follow her on Instagram at @Mary_Giuliani and on Twitter at @MaryGiuliani. I'm on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram as well, @abookishhome. If you have not taken a moment to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, please do that so you get notifications whenever there's a new episode. And if you have a moment to rate or review, that would also be so helpful. Thanks for listening and happy reading.